mindfulness. I may be just about to repeat a talk I did recently. I can't remember. It's poor mindfulness, isn't it? I could look it up. But the reason is there's been yet another article in the newspaper about mindfulness. And when I read these, although I'm very mindful, it does raise my hackles a little bit. This one was titled, "Is Mindfulness Making Us Ill?" A title which made me feel ill. As you may already have noticed, I really kind of disagree with that sentiment. The strap line was something along the lines of, "The relaxation technique of choice." I've got issues with that too. "Can have unexpected side effects." I've got issues with that too. The actual article itself, I did understand where people were coming from. And essentially people were practicing this thing that they were calling mindfulness. Please note the word. And there a few people, very few people, were experiencing things like panic attacks. Things that they felt that they had previously had dealt with came back up, and they reacted to those things. The article itself described there being a dark side of mindfulness. And all in all, it seems that what it was suggesting was that you had to be very careful with this thing called mindfulness. And indeed, that is true. You do have to be careful, but then you have to be careful crossing the road, don't you? You have to be careful. You know, reach a certain age, you have to be careful jumping out of bed too quickly. It can have unforeseen consequences, can't it? So you have to say care generally in life. But mindfulness is a wonderful, wonderful practice. It has just the most incredible benefits. And what struck me about reading this article and reading other articles of the same ilk is that there is a complete misunderstanding about what mindfulness is and what the practice of mindfulness is. If you regard mindfulness as a relaxation technique, you've already gone wrong. It's so much more than just a relaxation. If somebody wants relaxation, then why don't they just pick up a good book? Why not just go on a nice canal boat holiday? Because that's what relaxation gives you, isn't it? Mindfulness has far greater purpose. And I understand, of course, I understand that people perhaps don't have the vision of what mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness, can actually accomplish. But nonetheless, I feel that in our capacity here, that absolutely we need to teach the right way, the Buddha's way, the Noble Eightfold Path, which includes in it the practice and the development of mindfulness. So what I'd like to talk about tonight is there are three main components. The first is that stressing the importance of understanding the theory behind mindfulness, the what and why of mindfulness, and so setting it in its proper theoretical context of the Buddha's teaching and stressing the importance of that. Stressing the importance of ancillary or supportive practices that we do as part of the Buddha's teaching that both protect us and ensure that we don't have any of these mishaps, and also are training tools themselves that we can use to help to enhance and develop mindfulness practice, and also the importance of receiving proper skilled guidance. And in incorporating these other aspects of the Buddha's teaching in mindfulness practice, that's what ensures that these experiences that people have are dealt with well, skillfully, by the practitioner themselves. For it is the case that, and I remember it was the case for me when I had arrived here 2001, and I started practicing mindfulness under the instruction of my teacher, Alan. As a full-time student, I became a monk. But even before I'd become a monk, I had gone into his office and complained that it was all getting worse, not better. I'd been there 2 months, and it was all getting worse, not better. And he sat in his chair and giggled, like I giggle when you come and tell me that. Because it was a sign that actually the practice was working. And that's why you need so much more than just a 6-week starter course in mindfulness. That's why you need the support of skilled teachers and an environment to practice in and a theoretical background to give context to what's actually happening. Essentially, what happens to people when they react so strongly to this mindfulness practice, and I will come on to what mindfulness actually is. The reason they react is because they fall foul of what the Buddha called the passionate response. You have to learn to allay the passionate response. Thinking in context of the Buddha's teaching, his enlightenment was the realization of what we call the Four Noble Truths, which, to sum up as briefly as I can, we suffer whenever we resist life passionately. Whenever we say life shouldn't be like this, the shoulds and the oughts, and there is that passionate clinging to the notion that life is wrong and it should be different, that is when we suffer. And that itself is coming from an ignorant grasp of life. It's not saying that we're stupid, far from it. There are some incredibly clever people in the world, but they are nonetheless blind to the true nature of reality. And the Buddha maintained that it's possible for anybody to realize the true nature of life. And in letting go of that blindness and seeing life as it truly is, you let go of that insane resistance. And it is quite mad to resist life and insist that life should be different. So when people react negatively in their mindfulness practice, it's not a side effect of mindfulness. It's a side effect of ignorance, of not knowing, of blindness, of not understanding. It's almost like my analogy for it is it's like staring out of a window and demanding that it should always be sunny, and then seeing some clouds and some rain and reacting passionately and then blaming the window. What is mindfulness? Mindfulness is not something that you have to create. It's not something that you have to construct. Unless at this moment you are literally completely thinking about something else and are not listening to me at all, then you are actually employing mindfulness at this moment. Everyone employs mindfulness. You can't help it. You couldn't exist without employing mindfulness. Mindfulness is simply, and I know you've heard, many of you will have heard this term so many times that it becomes, you know, it sort of just doesn't really connect, but it is choiceless awareness. Before you choose whether you like something or not, before you choose whether you agree with something or not, there is just a simple awareness of what is. Experiencing it now. That's simply what mindfulness is. It's a mental quality that we all use routinely. And I think that's partly, it's part of the puzzle as to why people get so confused, is that they don't recognise that mindfulness is simply the quality that we all utilise, and that the practice of mindfulness is simply choosing to utilise that particular mental quality in specific ways. So, for instance, when you come along for meditation training, what's the first object that we choose to utilise this mental quality of mindfulness, of choiceless awareness? We utilise it to observe the breathing process when we meditate, to observe that tactile sensation. And what else do we utilise it for? We utilise it to then observing this choiceless awareness of anything else that occurs in our experience that takes us away from that central focus of the breathing process. So already we're not inventing mindfulness. We're just utilising. The practice is just utilising something that we already have. Which brings me on to another point about the way people talk about mindfulness that sort of gets my goat a little bit. People talk about secular mindfulness. But is there a religious mindfulness? The opposite of mindfulness is forgetfulness. Is there secular forgetfulness? Oh, I can't approve of that. It's not secular forgetfulness. It doesn't count. That's a bit of an aside. But anyway, the point being that, okay, it's a mental quality that we all utilise, but we're utilising it in specific ways. And it's having the understanding that our overarching aim is to understand, to have clear comprehension of suffering, the causes of suffering, and the way to alleviate and eliminate suffering. So that's a long, long, long way away from the practice of mindfulness as a relaxation technique. So it is inevitable that when somebody starts to practice in the right way, what is it that they begin to see? They begin to see their fears, their anxieties, their anger, unbidden memories, unwanted memories, unwanted perceptions arise. And without the correct theoretical structure and narrative to go with it, it's inevitable that people respond passionately, because that's what we've been doing our whole lives. That's why the theoretical underpinning of Buddha's teaching is there. That's why ideas about action and results are there, of rebirth, of condition-dependent origination, taking it on a bit further, a bit deeper. The Buddha gave us his most wonderful description of reality. Now, all descriptions of reality are inaccurate by definition. For me, the Buddha's teaching is the least inaccurate description of how life works that you'll ever come across. Absolutely brilliant. Wonderful. It explains in detail, step by step, how it is that an unwanted experience occurs. And it explains exactly, step by step, how it is that the mind responds to that. And in responding to that, creates the seeds of a future experience. It's just the most wonderful explanation, not explanation, description of reality. If you have that theoretical narrative to go with your practice, you are far less likely to succumb to that passionate response, because you've got a context for what's actually taking place. The beautiful thing about the Buddha's teaching is it's not a belief system. We're not a faith school. You have to have faith, of course, but you have to have faith to jump in a car and go zooming off down the motorway. We have beliefs, but they only act as placeholders. beliefs are only there as a temporary measure until we come to see things directly for ourselves, and that's the hallmark of the Buddha's teaching. Nothing has to be taken on pure faith alone. You have to have faith to undertake the practice. But the point is, you can come to understand this whole process of how the experience comes into being, how it unfolds, how the mind works, how mind and body interrelate, how consciousness works. You can come to comprehend that all simply by learning to utilize mindfulness in particular ways. So that theoretical underpinning is essential. It has to be there. It is undoubtedly the case that whilst we are in training, unwanted mental and physical events will unfold. We can do a lot to dampen the effects of our inefficient past actions by the way we choose to behave now. The Buddha gave a wonderful analogy that I use often because it's so simple and he explains it so well. You've got a cup of water and you just sprinkle a pinch of salt in the water. That water becomes undrinkable. You put that same pinch of salt in a freshwater lake and it makes no difference at all. The way we choose to behave, the way we choose to act, has results. Therefore, if we learn about what are wholesome actions and we choose to perform those actions, we can create, as it were, a reservoir of good results for ourselves. So that when the unwanted, say, a memory of a past trauma does arise in the mind, it arises in a mind which is full of good stuff. The resultant of a past inefficient action in the mind of somebody who is internally corrupt just breaks them. So, two main areas that the Buddha's teaching helps us with in this. Restraint of inefficient actions through keeping precepts, and the development of wholesome actions through the development of what we call the parami, perfections. You create a really wholesome state of being, for want of a better word, which makes mindfulness so much easier. If you've got no guilty dreads about actions that you've performed, which are negative. So refraining from, undertaking the training to refrain from killing or harming living creatures leads to a much more settled mind. Undertaking the rule of training to refrain from stealing will lead to a much calmer and steadier mind. Same with sexual misconduct. The same with, and I know this is one of the difficult ones, the last two are the most difficult for most people, it seems. Wrong speech, refraining from lying, tale-bearing and so forth, and refraining from mind-altering drink and drugs. There are rules of training. So not only do they help protect us, but they actually, by keeping the precepts, you actually help the development of this choiceless awareness. Because as you go through life, you're brought face to face with options. You are given the choice. That's what life does. It gives us the choice, putting it in a conventional way, to choose an efficient course of action or an inefficient course of action, to choose, make a wholesome response to a situation or make an unwholesome response to a situation. How do we learn which is which? It can only be through experience. So for the meditator, and again this sort of knocks this whole relaxation idea on the head again, skillful meditator doesn't mind making mistakes. Ethical mistakes, because the skillful meditator is able to learn from it. If you feel bad, if you feel a sense of, God, I really hope no one finds out about that. Then there's a good chance that you probably shouldn't have done it. But that's all right, because you experience that. And what do we understand about all these mental qualities that we observe? They don't last. But do you have the context? Do you have the context of the law of karma, law of action and result, to be able to say, this bad feeling is experiencing the result of that past action. Therefore, give me another opportunity and I'll really try not to behave like that. And it could be something as simple as, just having said something at work or looked at something inappropriate on the internet and you feel bad. So that's the natural resultant. Don't worry. It's fine. Experience the resultant. If you experience the result, that's the result of that kind of action. And so it has a very organic, natural effect of just, you learn as you go along. This idea that, I'm a Buddhist now, so I've got to be really good. No, a really good Buddhist is sometimes bad. Do you know what I mean? Because I think that's so important. Because otherwise we build up a conceit that I have to behave in a special way. You let the practice, you keep the precepts as part of this toolkit and learning about life. So it's an organic process of learning rather than trying to maintain a persona of a good person. You know what I feel about people who put on that persona of being good. So, yes, I think that's something along the lines of what I wanted to say. Training under guidance. And this was a very good point that was made in the article, actually. They said, if bad stuff's going down, go and talk to somebody. Who understands? A good mindfulness practitioner or a good teacher. There's nothing wrong in displaying your dark side. Like I say, there's a Darth Vader in us all. As a teacher, I know when the student has got the right idea because they talk about the dark side. They talk about the anger that they discovered they had in them. Well, they weren't denying it anymore. And they get the thumbs up again. It's so clear. The teacher doesn't mind. There is very, after, getting on for 15 years of teaching people, there ain't a lot left that could shock me, really. And don't forget that I'm a human being too. So, there ain't a lot really. And when the student realises that they don't have to put on airs and graces, they don't have to try and present an image of, look at me, I'm all this good stuff. That kind of doesn't ring true. When somebody comes in, but they're free mentally and they're able to express really what's going on, then you're really into true mindfulness. Mindfulness is choiceless awareness. You're not picking and choosing. So that developing that relationship with a skilled teacher, I think, makes so much difference. Because, of course, what's the teacher always going to just be reassuring? That's fine, you're human. Yeah, we all make mistakes. Recognise what this is telling you. Can you see the links of condition-dependent origination here? Can you see how the contact leads to the feeling and the feeling leads to the response? I should really talk about how we practice mindfulness. Mindfulness is choiceless awareness. So we've already discussed this evening mindfulness of breathing and observing the wandering mind and various distractions and bringing the mind to bear and labelling properly what's taking place and bringing the mind back. But another important aspect is recognising that the mindfulness and the practice of mindfulness is something that unfolds and grows and begins to seep out of the seated practice and starts to become a part of our everyday life. And that mindfulness can be developed in all kinds of different situations. It's not limited to seated meditation. I was on retreat a couple of weeks ago, spent a week on retreat, and I was reading a biography of the Thai monk Achan Mun. Mun, I think it's pronounced. Achan Mun, who was an extraordinarily dedicated Thai monk. He lived in the forest. He only ate one meal a day. He was absolutely... I found him really inspiring because it's so easy in our modern life to have the desire to live a mindful life, and then we get home from work and we turn on the telly and it all just, you know, we just forget about it all. He didn't have a telly even. He didn't even have internet connection. My goodness, how did he even survive? But he devoted his life to the practice of walking meditation and seated meditation, and he was an extraordinary practitioner. I thoroughly recommend his biography, but I'm reading it at the moment, so I have to wait until it goes back in the library. So I thought, inspired by that, I would really take mindfulness seriously outside of the seated practice. And it is amazing what you can accomplish. It's amazing what you can discover about yourself. Walking meditation is very similar to seated practice. It's that rather than taking the breathing process, that tactile sensation as your main focus, you take the sensation of the soles of the feet. You have, obviously, the pressure changes. You have the motion. You have temperature changes, the subtle temperature changes as the foot moves through its various processes. But the same policy applies to you as you're observing your footfall and you... The mind wanders. Where does it wander to? What do you start thinking about? What else is going on in your experience? Does the mind get taken away to sounds, to smells, to tastes? Are there other touches involved? And that process, if you do it assiduously, and that's why, again, why coming on retreat is such a brilliant idea, because all your ordinary responsibilities are taken away and you can just focus exclusively on developing your mindfulness. It's incredible, if you do it assiduously, how quiet the mind becomes and how much you see about what's actually going on in your experience, whether it's internally in your body or externally in the physical world, whether it's in your mental universe and what's taking place. Extraordinary things. And it's all about choiceless awareness, not throwing something out because it doesn't fit your description of what you think ought to be there. Throw out all those descriptions of what you think meditation should be. Meditation should be calm, meditation should be relaxed, meditation should be this, that and the other. Throw it all away. What's actually taking place in your experience right now? That's where the true interest with mindfulness comes. This ever unfolding conscious experience that's never ever the same for two moments, that you've always taken so for granted. You've never looked. And you've never been in a position to truly comprehend how fleeting, how insubstantial, how empty life really is. And it's a delightful emptiness. It's the emptiness of not having to worry. It's the emptiness of not having to be anxious. It's the emptiness of having to that sense that you are unfulfilled and you have to somehow make life count. It's a freedom from all of that. It's the freedom just to enjoy life as it unfolds and discover there are so many more levels to life than you were ever previously aware of. There is so much more going on. It's so much more mysterious than ever you had realized. And all these realizations come from being willing to go that extra step
and introducing mindfulness into more and more areas of your life. So you come on a retreat, say, perhaps you come on an integrated retreat, and you choose to, you're given a little task to do in the afternoon, a little bit of clearing up in the garden, or a little bit of housework. And so you choose to do it with mindfulness. But there's a determination and an intent to really do it mindfully, to really want to know, to really want to note and examine and be with this unfolding reality, rather than just being lost in that same old daydream or that same old worry, that same old habitual routine that just goes round and round and round and round but never really accomplishes anything. You just have to have a certain amount of determination, a certain amount of persistent, gentle application to acknowledging what comes up. Same old, same old. Okay, put it down. Come back. What's happening in my experience now? 2 minutes later, same old track, same old track. What is it? It's worry. Put it down. Move on. So you're never in a conflict with what's going on. You're never saying, I shouldn't be there. Because that's more or less blaming the window again, isn't it? Well, it is there. That's the reality. But the more you do it, the more that becomes, oh, that's just worry. Oh, that's just that same old daydream that I always do. And it becomes easier and easier to put it down because it's transient. And the more you see that something is transient, the less it bothers you. You can't be bothered by something that's transient. To know that it was transient means that it's already gone. Why be bothered about that? So over time you develop this incredible, and you can do mindfulness, you can do mindfulness walking to your car, the practice of mindfulness, the practice of utilizing mindfulness. You can, while you're driving along, while you're parking, while you're walking to the office, while you're making a cup of tea when you get to the office, it's just a decision. It's just repeatedly choosing it again and again. That's what I mean by assiduous. It's just, no, I want to do this. I want to do this. I want to do this. And there's no conflict in it because there's no expectation. Because it isn't about being relaxed. It isn't about being peaceful. And you're going to say to me, as a last thought, because I know I've already gone over. As a last thought, you're going to say to me, well, what about the peace? What about the freedom? What about the happiness? And to that I would say, as you practice and as you discover more and more that you can actually put the thinking down, and the more you discover how transient the thinking is, and the more the thinking becomes negligible and the real focus becomes on exploring your unfolding reality, you'll discover that your natural state is perfectly peaceful, perfectly happy, perfectly confident. You don't have to create peace and happiness and confidence with life. That's your true nature. But there's all this junk on top, and that's what you're sifting through. So there's no point looking for happiness. Just look at what's actually taking place. Truly comprehend it. Mindfulness is nothing in and of itself. It doesn't mean anything. It only means something because it brings understanding, a clear comprehension of the true nature of what's happening. And as that develops, and you let go of all these psychological trials and tribulations that you put yourself through, you discover more and more that your true nature, unconditioned nature, is happy, peaceful, confident. I should look at my notes more often. I don't know. What did I say? Something about mindfulness. The most important thing is having a context for the practice. So having a good theoretical understanding. So listening to talks, talking to your teacher, reading books, all that kind of stuff. utilizing various parts of the teaching, like precepts and parami, to protect you and to help with the training. And yes, revealing your dark side to your teacher is a good thing. Thumbs up for that, definitely. And always remembering that everything about the Buddha's teaching is, he always said that there was nothing in the closed fist of the teacher. What he meant by that he had explained everything, that he gave everything. The Buddha's teaching is neither excessive nor deficient in what it offers. It just gives you exactly what you need to realize freedom from suffering. So, as long as you've got all those aspects there, there is no reason why you cannot practice mindfulness assiduously. You won't come to any harm. It won't make you ill. Quite the reverse. It will bring happiness, peace and contentment.